Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Our big conversation today looks at transportation from a few different angles. There's no doubt the pandemic has altered how we move around, with car trips way up and more people cycling. But transportation that involves being around other people, well, that's way down. Probably no surprise. Buses, trains, planes. We'll speak with an expert about how COVID-19 has altered the transportation outlook in California and what we should expect in the months and even years to come. Also, new research that shows what all of the car exhaust is doing to the health of our children now and as they grow into adults. Plus, what local cities are doing to encourage getting around on foot or by bike during this period of social distancing. But first, today is the day that experts with the state of California's Department of Water Resources head up Highway 50 into the Sierra to Phillips Station for the monthly check of the winter snowpack. DWR spokesperson Chris Orrock is at the test site this morning and joins us now to help us understand what we need to know about the snowpack totals. Chris, nice to have you on Insight again.
Good morning, Randall. Thanks for having me.
So this morning's survey has not happened yet, right? But you do have some sense of what it's going to show?
Well, I'm actually sitting here right outside Phillips Station right now. And, you know, we do about 260 manual snow surveys every month within a couple days of the first of the month. So we've been out there the last week surveying a variety of sites across the state, and that combined with our statewide automated snow pillows, our snowpack is in the high 50s, low 60% of average for this time of year.
Mm. When was the last time we had a snowpack? Could we call this bleak as the current one?
Well, I would say we're probably entering into a critically dry year, especially after a well below average 2020. We're on track for about the same type of hydrologic or the amount of precipitation as it was in 2014-15, which was the height of the last severe drought that we had here in California.
Mm. There is some indication that the, as they say, storm door may open up in the coming days. DWR, sure isn't counting on it, but Miracle March sure would be nice, right?
Well, yeah, Miracle March would be nice, but that also comes with some dangers, because on average we have about 3 inches of rain in the month of March for California. A Miracle March, we're talking 300 to 400% of an average March. With that brings the possibility of flooding. The more if we increase that much, if we have that much precipitation coming down, it's going to really inundate the system and cause localized flooding and probably increase releases from reservoirs in order to handle that type of rain and runoff coming into it. Mm. So while we do need a lot of rain, we prefer it to come down in colder systems of snow, like that system that we had at the end of January, which was really the only major storm we've had this whole water year.
Yeah, quickly on the topic of the state's reservoirs, they're not in as good a shape as they were a year ago when we hit a dry spell.
Right, and that's because of 2019. 2019 was an incredible year as far as snowpack. In fact, it was the fifth best snowpack in California history. All that ran off and filled up those reservoirs and helped out last year when we had a dry year. But two consecutive dry years in a row, we can't count on that carryover from that great 2019. And then this year is even less precipitation than we had last year. Just a quick example, in 2019, we had over 40 atmospheric rivers just that year. The last 2 years combined, we've only had 2 atmospheric rivers.
Mm. And so this next one coming up, would that be considered an atmospheric river?
Well, we still don't know if that's going to impact California or not. Right now, it looks like it's going to kind of skirt to the south, and then the one this weekend is going to bring us a light amount of precipitation. It all depends on that high-pressure system, Randall. If it just moves a little bit to the east or west, it opens that storm door and allows those storms to impact us instead of just those edges of the storm coming into the extreme parts of California. We really need to see a series of good storms coming through over a period of days I mean, just to get us back up to average for January, February, and March, we would need almost 9 inches of rain for in the month of March. And like I said, that brings its own dangers of the potential for localized flooding as well.
Mm-hmm. Remind us as to how much the state depends on all of that water stored in the form of snow in the Sierra Nevada.
Yeah, on a normal year, the Sierra snowpack is 30% of our fresh water supply. So it's that three-legged stool. We have our reservoirs that capture the runoff, capture the rain. We have our groundwater, which was greatly depreciated in that last drought from 2011 to 2016. And then we have our snowpack. And the quality of the snowpack, when it stays cold, when it has slow runoff into the late spring, because in California, it doesn't rain in the late spring or summer and early fall. So we want that water to be running off to refill the reservoirs as we use it during those hot, dry summer months.
Mm-hmm. And with the depleted groundwater totals, and, you know, those get recharged through rainfall, which we haven't had either, it would force more farmers to tap into something that's already on its way down, right?
Right. And California took a huge step in 2015 and 16 in passing SGMA, the Sustained Groundwater Management Act, that now requires local entities to properly manage those aquifers so we don't get into that position that we had in the last drought, where they were just taking all the water out of those aquifers and not being able to supply water because it takes 5 to 6 years just to start rebuilding those aquifers from when they were depleted.
All right. California Department of Water Resources spokesperson Chris Orrick, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Randall. Thank you.
All right, let's shift now to our big conversation of the day, which is centered around transportation. Until engines are powered entirely by electricity, those living near freeways are going to face health issues from the pollutants found in vehicle exhaust. Cars and trucks are a major contributor to air pollution in California, and studies show those communities most affected tend to have large African-American and Latino populations. New research out of Stanford University shows this polluted air is also affecting the health of children. Let's now hear from Dr. Mary Prunicki. She's the Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at Stanford University. She's the lead author on this study, and she joins us now with details. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what did you learn in this study? Give us a sense of, you know, who you looked at and what you were looking for, I guess.
Yeah, so we were looking at kids, 6 to 8 year old children that live in the Central Valley. So they're continually exposed to levels of elevated air pollution. They lived in Fresno, which is always in the top 4 for poor air quality in the nation, actually. Mm-hmm. And these children had their blood drawn, and then we looked at the cells in their blood and compared it to the level of pollution they were exposed to.
Mm-hmm. And what did the testing of that blood show over time?
So we found a few interesting things. We confirmed, we already knew that when you're exposed to air pollution, it can change the regulation of your immune genes. So we found again that, we got down regulation of certain immune genes when you're exposed to air pollution. But this study took it a step further, and we used a new technology to look at immune cells one cell at a time. And with this technology, we were able to see that some immune cells actually are associated with levels of air pollution just one day prior to exposure, whereas others will be more sensitive to longer durations of exposure, such as, 30 days and even chronic exposure at 6 months.
And if your immune cells are being damaged in this way, what does that indicate in terms of your overall health?
Well, we know that when you have what we call immune dysregulation and you get an imbalance of your healthy and your non-healthy or, you know, immune cells, when you get like an inflammatory response, we know that that can kind of shift your allergic profile. And unfortunately, Fresno has higher asthma rates, quite a bit higher than other areas in California and the national average. So we know that air pollution is changing their allergic profile. It's associated with higher rates of asthma. And also in this study, we looked at blood pressure. And this has not been looked at a lot prior. There's been some studies that have been inconsistent, but in this one, we did find an association with the child's diastolic blood pressure and the amount of pollution exposure. And so that'll, of course, have to be replicated, and we need to do more studies to figure out, you know, how significant that is. But it does suggest that perhaps early pollution exposure, you know, may lead to more risk for adult, you know, high blood pressure or other types of chronic health problems.
The majority of children participating in this study were Latino. Is that right?
That's correct.
And was this a population spread throughout Fresno, or was it grouped closer to the main freeways, or how did that work?
Well, it was throughout Fresno. It was then Fresno Unified School District. And what we did is there's five EPA monitoring stations within that region, and we use an algorithm to estimate for a given child's home how much pollution exposure based on those five sensors they were probably being exposed to. So we tried to individualize it. Mm. But, you know, of course, that's assuming a child's standing on his front lawn 24 hours a day, which we know isn't true. And we know that indoor air pollution is a big source of harm, too. So yeah. These studies in general have a long way to go in terms of trying to estimate what a child is actually exposed to 24 hours a day.
What's the data on adults exposed to high pollution levels?
In adults, it is clear that it's associated with high blood pressure. Mm. So in adults, it's fairly consistent. We also know in adults globally, the more PM2.5 you're exposed to, which it happens to be the main component of wildfire smoke, the more PM2.5 that you're exposed to, the shorter your life expectancy. Mm. So we know, you know, overall exposure to pollutants will, you know, increase morbidity and mortality.
So in addition to vehicle exhaust and other sources of pollution, wildfires are becoming an increasingly concerning element here in California when it comes to the air quality and our health?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, you know, if we are able to see associations with regular air pollution at one day, you know, right now we're looking at studies for one day exposure to wildfire smoke, which obviously tends to be much more intense. You know, what is that doing to us? Or in the Bay Area, you know, last fall, 30 days of spare the air and poor air quality, you know, is that going to have long-term impacts on the entire community?
Yeah, I swapped my home air filter out, I think, three different times this past summer, and each time it was just as dark as could be. So I was thinking about how that's reflected in my lungs and my health.
Right.
Dr. Mary right. Pernicki, Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at Stanford University, we really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. And I know I made a scheduling mistake and had told you tomorrow. So
that's okay.
Really, I cannot underscore how much I appreciate you jumping on the call at the last moment this morning. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Up next, shifting to less polluting forms of transportation. We'll speak with a top scientist about how the pandemic has thrown a wrench into some of those plans, and an update on what Sacramento and some other cities are doing to get people out of their cars. Have a transportation-related question or concern for the experts? Shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org, or you can use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You are listening to Insight. This is your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is centered around transportation. Starting tomorrow, some of the world's top scientists and city planners who focus on transportation issues will convene, virtually this year, of course, at UC Davis for the annual Three Revolutions Conference. They'll dig into what it takes to electrify the cars and trucks we all drive, including those delivering goods and services around the state, plus look at where we are with automation or driverless vehicles, automation, and how prepared our infrastructure is for that coming change, and also shared mobility, you know, services like Lyft, Uber, DoorDash, even Lime bikes and spin scooters. One of the sessions at the conference will look at how the pandemic has affected our transportation patterns. Generally, data show car trips are way up and public transit is way down. Dr. Giovanni Cercella is the director of the Three Revolutions Future Mobility Program at UC Davis. He's the expert on this topic and joins us today to help us understand these trends. Great to have you on Insight.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start, Doctor, with a big generalization of the pandemic and transportation. In your opinion, do you believe it has helped or hindered our shift toward these three revolution tracks of electrification, automation, and shared mobility?
Well, the pandemic has certainly disrupted transportation and the entire society in so many ways. On transportation, the impact has been huge, and this has disrupted both long-distance travel and short-distance travel for all type of trips that we have usually in our days. When it comes to the three revolutions, and in particular the impact that the pandemic has had on shared mobility, electrification, and automation, it's evident that today nobody wants to share. So somehow the social distancing needs brought a big stop to the use of shared mobility. Today, options like a pool ride-hailing, Uber pool, a Lyft share, they're not even available anymore. But also all the other services, from public transportation to ride-hailing to scooter services, has gone down quite a bit.
I imagine
on the other topics.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, I imagine just standard carpooling is down too, not only because people don't want to be in the same car together, but not everyone is going into their office.
Exactly. That is a big change that is happening. Carpooling inside the same members, among the members of the same households, is still happening. But in general, like we see an increase in driving alone with individuals just driving their own vehicle. But if you want to look at some silver lining, it seems like, you know, electrification is taking steam during this time. And so this is probably going to be remembered as the year in which, for a number of reasons, companies are really switching and investing heavily and really believing in a market for electric vehicles also in the United States. And so that could be probably something that we will see more and more in the near future.
Yeah. Was it Ford or GM that announced that dozens of their car models would be coming out in electric versions?
GM has really made a huge transition. If we think that just a few months ago, GM was actually backing an effort from President Trump to stop the efforts of California to reduce emissions from vehicles, and now they have withdrawn the support to that effort, and they're completely committed to transition to electric vehicles, and they are announcing a lot of new vehicles that will be electrified and really switching pretty much their entire model fleet in the future.
And they have one of the best-selling cars also, electric cars, the Bolt, right? Is it can go more than 250 miles, which used to be a concern for people, was the distance of an electric vehicle could go compared to a gas-powered one.
It is true. And range still today, it is a big concern for many users, especially those that are not being exposed to an electric vehicle. Because the reality is that most of us, we don't need to drive 200 miles in the same day. But the concern, the psychological concern about not having enough range for our movements is actually a big barrier for many to switch to electric vehicles. And in this area, I think we need all of us to thank Tesla that somehow promoted the idea of having maybe not very affordable vehicles, but very long range electric vehicles, really like, you know, pushing the frontier and the boundary in expanding the market of the electric vehicles and also promoting wider acceptance in the general public.
Yeah, Tesla also made having an electric vehicle sexy, right? They changed the perception entirely. Now, you know, having a Tesla is kind of a big deal, right?
It is. And if you look at the other manufacturers, they are following. So Audi, all the luxury manufacturers are really looking at Tesla as a model to switch production and have high performance vehicles that really can be electric. So we can now combine electric environmental friendly vehicles together with having a car that is performing and pleasant and nice. So not anymore the early electric vehicles that were kind of, you know, small battery, little performance, but only done for the environment.
What will it take, Doctor, to make it so that electric vehicles can be as affordable as some of the other gas-powered economy cars?
Well, the problem today is still the battery. Producing the batteries is very expensive. We also have the problem of the depletion of the batteries. But in general, batteries require a lot of natural resources and rare materials that are used in it. And the manufacturing process still accounts for a very, very large component of the cost. There are also environmental concerns about, like, you know, the waste management of batteries, the recycling process. So there are a lot of things that make us also aware that switching to electric vehicles is not necessarily a good thing. And also, last thing, we need to think also that from the societal perspective, we need also to think about the primary source of energy. In California, we have a very green energy mix these days, but in other states, this is not true. And so burning coal to power an electric vehicle is not a good idea. And this happens in China, in India, in many other states in the United States, and it's something we should consider. Mm-hmm. But having said that, the problem right now on the transition to electrification is still the battery cost.
Yeah. So you mentioned range anxiety, and then we mentioned cost as a barrier. Also, one other concern is for some people, they'll think, well, where will I charge it? I guess the best gas station in terms of charging your car would be at your own home, right? You just plug it in. But once you get on the road, people might have concern. Last night, the Petaluma City Council, Petaluma's in the North Bay, Sonoma County, voted unanimously to ban new gas stations. The move also streamlines, apparently, the steps needed for existing gas stations to add electric vehicle charging stations and potential hydrogen fuel stations, according to the city's Argus Courier newspaper. That first city in California to do that, what are your thoughts?
Well, that is a sign of the importance of having public support for the process of electrification. If we look at European countries like Norway, Iceland, but even Germany, so big markets that are transitioning toward electric vehicles, a lot of the importance for that transition is also associated with the availability not only of models on the market, but also the possibility to charge these vehicles. And I would say also in the United States, we need to consider also all the other applications of electrification. We need to do more efforts, for example, for fleets. We need to consider also the process that can happen in the shared mobility sector. So in our Three Revolution program, as we look at all these different revolutions, we are interested also at the electrification, for example, of the Uber and Lyft fleets and all the other vehicles that more and more are crowding our streets these days to deliver goods and carry around people, but still have a limited portion of their fleet that is electrified.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, is there somewhat of a fourth revolution going on, and that would be transporting ourselves via Zoom and other methods to telecommute, teleconference? You know, a year ago, you would probably be sitting here in the Insight studio, as would our other guests. But today you're at home. You didn't have to jump in a car or get on light rail or whatever it might have been. So it seems like it's almost this whole separate category.
Absolutely. Information communication technologies are providing a lot of options that have been on the market for a while, but the pandemic has really pushed towards a higher adoption. And this is very big for all forms of remote working and telecommuting, but also for online shopping that has seen a big uptick during the pandemic. And a big question that we ask in the research community these days is how much of these trends are temporary versus what would be the longer term impacts of the pandemic? Because many of us that have been working from home during the pandemic, probably we were not doing it before the pandemic, but now that we're experiencing it every day during the pandemic, we might continue to do so perhaps 1 or 2 days a week, also after the disruption is over, and that could have huge impacts on society. But it's also very important to consider the equity impacts of this, because not all of us are the privileged that can work from home, that have the possibility to replace commuting trips with other options. And this is something that needs to be studied much more. We're working with California agencies actually to support more insights and better informed policies to really support all the communities or lower income workers, minorities that in many cases are predominantly consider essential workers. They need to report to work in person, and they actually been affected by the pandemic much more than other groups of the population.
Doctor, I don't know if you're able to answer this or not. Our next guest actually might be able to, if you can't. Ron from Sacramento wrote in to say, why aren't charging stations utilized to help keep scooters and e-bikes charged and parked in an orderly fashion?
Well, that's a very good question. And I would say that the scooters and electric bikes have gone already into transformation over the past few years. You might remember when scooters and bikes actually had to be picked up at night to go to charge somewhere. And so there were these vans going around to pick up all these vehicles. These days, a lot of companies are actually switching to replaceable batteries. So the van and the operator just comes with a replacement battery, and the scooter doesn't need to go home to charge, but it can be use a replaceable battery. But also there are opportunities to improve this process further, especially like, you know, as a co-benefit of other changes in design and the use of a renewable power. One of our colleagues, a professor in the School of Design at UC Davis, is actually testing these days a newly designed charging station, which is 100% powered by solar energy, and it will be on campus to allow the possibility to charge electric bikes and scooters.
Let's talk a little bit about those spaces that some of us are a little awkward to get into during the pandemic, including buses, trains, and those sort of shared spaces. Those will be with us for the foreseeable future. In fact, we're building, you know, new lines as we speak. Will it take high levels of vaccination to switch that drop in ridership back to increasing numbers? The California Transit Association issued a statement yesterday, as a matter of fact, in response to the agreement reached by Governor Gavin Newsom and state lawmakers to reopen California schools, expressing a little bit of concern that frontline transit workers, who will play, of course, a critical role in delivering students back to the classroom, are still not prioritized for the COVID-19 vaccine. So does this just sort of underscore that role that vaccinations will play?
Vaccines have a very, very important role in the reopening and the recovery process of society. And certainly a lot of users will not feel comfortable using shared modes of transportation, being it riding a bus or being in a vehicle from Uber, unless they are vaccinated and they feel like, you know, the virus is less of a threat. But also we need to consider the habit changing. We know that our cities, especially the denser cities like San Francisco, all like, you know, the areas that have like, you know, a lot of commuters and a lot of residents in a limited amount of land, need to work with public transportation. There's no way everybody can drive a car around simply because there is not enough space for everybody to be in a car. But we are right now a little bit of a risk of an increased car dependence of society, because it's not only the concern about the pandemic that might be a temporary effect, but might have also kind of a longer term impact in society, but it's also the habit formation that when workers for a long time has started to use cars to commute to their jobs or to just run their errands. And we have even our research is showing some of those that were living in big cities without a car or with few cars in the household that are actually showing increased interest in owning cars and buying new cars. That can lead to habit formation that could be actually difficult to fight in the future. So really, this will be a very important policy topic in the future to really try to counteract and reduce this car dependence on society.
Dr. Giovanni Ciurcella is the director of the Three Revolutions Future Mobility Program at UC Davis. He's a star speaker this week for their Three Revolutions Conference. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, nice to speak with you. Bicycle use has increased dramatically during the pandemic. There's a silver lining. According to the BBC, some studies in the U.S. showed a threefold increase in bicycle trail use, and one in 10 Americans reported using a bike for the first time in more than a year or longer. Fitness apps also showing a surge in bicycle riding in 2020, and some countries even rewarded residents who purchased bicycles with governmental cashback programs in both France and Italy. In the U.S., even without those incentives, bike shops saw major inventory drops, making it hard for somebody to purchase a new bike or parts if they wanted to. The organization People for Bikes, based in Colorado, reports roughly 200 U.S. cities changed the flow of their streets to accommodate more cycling and other outdoor activities. Sacramento was a little late to the game with that one, but just recently jumped on board with a Slow Streets program of its own. For more on that and other changes being made in the Sacramento region to encourage cycling, let's bring in Executive Director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, or SABA for short, Deborah Banks. It's always great to speak with you, Deborah. Thanks for coming on the show this morning.
Good morning, Randall. Great to see you, as always.
Yeah, so Slow Streets, let's talk about how that rolled out here in Sacramento, and how's it going?
Well, as you said, we were late to the party, but that's okay. We're here now. We have 2.5 miles roughly of Slow Streets up and running, implemented in the city. The first was a pilot of the pilot. This is a pilot project. And the pilot of the pilot was in Land Park. So the circle in Land Park was closed off. And a lot of that was so that the city could manage the placing of signs and get that, you know, oriented in a safe space before putting it out on our streets. And then the first set of streets is about 1.5 miles or so, is in the Midtown Newton Booth area. And the Midtown Neighborhood Association with Newton Booth worked with the city to identify their streets. They did a lot of public engagement and then finally got things up and running just 2 weeks ago on Valentine's Day, actually. And so they're up and they're running, meaning that the streets are closed off. Regular traffic can go through, people that live there can go through, but the idea is that other traffic, regular city traffic, would go alternative spaces, and that the main part of the street is open for walkers, bikers, joggers, skaters, scooters, anybody but, you know, you in a car, unless you live there.
I accidentally found myself riding through it, and yeah. I saw a woman out on her porch, so I stopped and asked her, were you consulted? How do you feel about this? And she said, yeah, that, you know, she took part in a survey and that so far, so good. She really likes having it. And she is seeing people use it and walking in the streets. You know, it makes it easier for social distancing.
Right. That's the whole purpose, the whole original purpose of this when the pandemic hit coming up on a year ago. Oh my gosh. The idea was that people didn't have enough room to spread out and walk safely, or at least, you know, that was the concern and the fear. And that's why cities all over, planners just went right in and said, let's close these streets for people. And at the earliest stages, planners did it to their communities. And as things rolled out, there was much more engagement, et cetera. And so that's where Sacramento has done a really good job. The city's process includes a lot of engagement and it's community led. So it's not like the city is coming in and saying, we're going to close this street. We know what's best. tons of engagement is coming up, and it's coming up from community. It's all community-led, community leaders and ambassadors. That part's really nice.
Deborah, I'm wondering, you mentioned Land Park and also Newton Booth in the Midtown area. Those are both higher income areas. Does the city have plans to put any of these slow streets in neighborhoods that don't have as many resources?
So there's a total of 6 miles of streets available, meaning that's the number, the amount of space we can close down for the materials that we have, signage and all that kind of stuff. And so the city opened up, an application process that was very simple. It was a low threshold to jump over. Tahoe Park came in with a couple of possibilities. Oak Park came in with a couple of possibilities. Cabrillo Park and another space up in Del Paso. So the idea again was, it's got to be community led, and EJ communities, environmental justice communities, would get a higher priority in terms of working with the city to get those implemented. So there's definitely an approach to make sure that underserved communities have access.
And we should mention that these slow streets are not just for bicycles, it's for pedestrians and all sorts of outdoor activity that can take place in the streets.
Absolutely. And for some of the areas that are working on their slow streets, they're trying to figure out a way to get to essential services. So it's not just like M Street, which is a fabulous street and is the closest thing to a bicycle boulevard that we have. But M Street links you from parts to town, but it doesn't take you to a grocery store or to a health, a health clinic. And that's the other idea, is that you're trying to get to essential services and help people get to these places.
Mm-hmm. The city has, over the last few years, also been rolling out these protected bike lanes, mostly, again, in the midtown and downtown areas. How are those working out? Are people adapting to those?
Yeah, I mean, right now, as we just heard, with more people staying at home, the streets are so much quieter. So you don't see as many people on the streets and commuting, which is the majority of people that would be using those streets. We had a lights on project where, and we've done this in years past, where we stand out in different street corners at dusk and stop commuters and cyclists that don't have lights on their bikes and give them blinkies so that they can be seen. And it's been, very successful. And this year, as we did it in the, winter months, there just weren't that many people commuting. So we had very few people that we were stopping. So, they're there, they are being used, they're great, and we need more of them. They take a lot of planning and a lot of thinking about. And so, everything because of the pandemic has shifted some of the priorities from the city. And so these things are still in the works and they're still being done. But there's also now kind of a larger picture of how do they all fit together, mm-hmm. meaning trying to get a great, interconnected network of these kinds of bicycle throughways for people to ride on.
And for people that may not be familiar with these protected bike lanes, you have the sidewalk, then you have the bike lane, then you have the parked cars, then you have street traffic. Whereas in a traditional way, the bike lane and the parked cars would be swapped. The parked cars would be adjacent to the sidewalk and the bikes would be traveling right there with the moving vehicles. So there are a number of dangerous streets for cyclists in any city. Broadway and Stockton in Sacramento are among those busy streets here. And they're, like you mentioned, they're those connector streets. They're sometimes they go diagonally, and so they're the fastest way to get from A to B. But if you're a cyclist, you don't want to be on that street. However, there are plans to change Broadway and Stockton to make them more bike and pedestrian friendly, right?
Absolutely. Stockton Boulevard Project and the Stockton Broadway, they are both high injury networks, which means that in our corridors, we do counts, can get an idea of how many injuries happen in a certain area. This is some of the highest, injury network in the city. So it's big on the city planners, docket. It's at the top. And they've been doing a lot of work on this, again, with a lot of community engagement. So In February, I think it was February 10th or so, there was a pretty good sized meeting that the city went through, and you can get online right now and put in your, there's a survey that you can add in your 2 cents about it. Aggie Square is also going in. So there's a lot of moving pieces that need to come together. And that's one of the beauties of these projects is in the old days, you would have, you know, transportation planners or urban, you know, planners doing what they needed to do in their silos. And now people are starting to come together and work collectively for the betterment of the whole area. Yeah. And it still also has deep community engagement. And that might slow down the process, but it's going to make it deeper and richer and something that everybody can live with and, you know, embrace. That's good.
Really quickly, the Broadway will be the first one to see changes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's that stretch that is closer to downtown, I guess would be
yes,
the easiest way to put that.
Yes, over by 4th area. Yeah.
Right.
The triangle.
In about 30 seconds, can you tell me about the 15-minute city?
Yes. The 15-minute city is this idea from urban planners. It came out of Paris, who their mayor has been fantastic about closing streets. And the idea is instead of talking about mobility, it's about access. So do you as an individual have access to parks, groceries, healthcare, schools, cultural events within a 15-minute walk or ride from your house? So the idea is that everybody can get wherever they need to for those essential services with walking or a very short bicycle distance.
Excellent.
We can do this. It would be a fantastic thing in Sacramento.
Deborah Banks, Executive Director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, or SABA. Always appreciate speaking with you. Thank you for the updates.
Thanks, Randall. Appreciate it.
Still ahead, heavy adoption of electric vehicles in California could, get this, help secure our power grid to avoid future rolling blackouts. We'll explain how that will work just ahead. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Today's big conversation revolves around transportation. And recently, our colleagues up at our sister station, North State Public Radio in Chico, focused on the transition to electric vehicles in California for the weekly show Blue Dot. In order to keep all of those future EVs charged and ready to go, the state is going to need an upgraded and reliable power grid. In fact, the cars themselves could help with a future smart grid, as host of NSPR's Blue Dot, Dave Shulm, found out after speaking with an expert on the matter.
While investigating the Texas power outages, I got to thinking about the state of our grid here in California. While the state is trying to lead the way in terms of renewable energy and the push for electric vehicles, its power grid has been anything but reliable in recent years, in part due to extreme weather.
You don't need to be an engineer to see that our grid need a huge investment in order to be much more resilient to weather.
That's Gil Tall. He's the director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at UC Davis. He says that electric car sales were poor in the past, partially because of limitations of the technology, mainly lack of places to charge your car and poor battery performance. But the lithium-ion battery is changing everything.
Another technology, lithium-ion batteries, that make electric cars relevant again. About 12 years ago, the first Tesla Roadsters and then the Nissan Leaf and electric cars are back. And they are right now a strong competitive with internal combustion engine cars. So they're getting to be in Norway about 80% of the sales, in California about 8%.
So right now, electric cars make up only 8% of car sales in California. But what happens to the electric grid when the number rises closer to that of Norway, 80%? With more and more cars being charged, will the grid be able to handle it?
Now, electric vehicles will be another load, a new load. So we need to make sure that we have a reliable system for this new load. But since they are a huge battery that park most of the time and on the road very small share of the time, they can be also part of the solution. Just one part. It's not the main solution, but it can be part of the solution too.
It can be part of the solution by understanding what is known as the duck curve.
The duck curve is this excess electricity we have during the day today, even today, and it's keep growing every year.
The duck curve is a graph of the overgeneration of electricity from solar looked at over the period of a single day. When you graph it out, it looks like the profile of a duck, with most of the unutilized solar energy occurring between noon and 3 p.m., when the sun is the most intense. This is particularly an issue in California due to the relatively high amount of solar energy produced here.
And the demand during the day, at least on the West Coast, is not that high.
So the demand for energy is significantly lower in the day than the amount generated from solar and wind, and this is where the smart grid comes into play.
So when your solar panels create electricity, that's a great time to charge your car. When you need more power for other things, or when there is a cloud above your home, we can stop charge for a while.
Meaning your car only utilizes the grid's energy when there is excess energy available.
And the third way is just to charge our electric cars during the day. And this is exactly what we're trying to do. Charge our electric cars during the day. An electric car, or any car, is usually being parked for 22 hours a day, and we just need to find them in the right place to put chargers there. 40% of the cars are being used for commute. That's easy. The other 60%, we need to find them and to charge them during the day.
And this act alone makes sure that electric cars don't add to the burden of the grid. And it basically is the premise of the smart grid: match energy usage to energy availability.
So the very simple way is that you control, it's what we call V1G. When you control the charging, you can stop it, restart it, make it faster, make it slower, but control how the vehicle is being charged. In a similar way, there is a control over HVAC systems and so on. That's the very basic way of a smart grid. A better or a more evolved way of smart grid is the one that also the car can supply energy back to the grid. So what we call vehicle to grid, and that's go both ways.
Which means that when there's a spike in energy demand, the grid draws from the thousands of batteries of parked electric vehicles for the extra power needed that was stored when there was excess energy produced earlier. So the extra batteries are acting like a reservoir, storing energy to be used when it's needed, compared to just drawing from a river where if you don't use it, it flows into the ocean.
But it's all going to happen behind the scenes. And when we come back to the car at the end of the day, we have a fully charged car and we just drive it home. And we feel we feel really good with ourselves because we drive it home on sunshine. We drive it home on clean and very efficient energy.
And it's helping stabilize the load on the grid, which can ultimately help the power generating plants run more economically as well.
It's optimizing not just the generators, as we start talking about coal versus cleaner generation. It's also optimizing the loads on the local distribution grid. So we don't need to upgrade specific nodes in our network. We can actually manage the load on these nodes.
Meaning that spikes in energy demand are much less likely to cause blackouts. And Gil says that in the not-too-distant future, it won't affect the user experience of driving or owning an electric car.
You know, that's the nice thing about electric cars. They will be parked wherever they park today, and we will have many more chargers, and we will come in the morning to work and plug in the car and leave. And by the time we finish our day and go back home, the car will be fully charged. We won't even know that in the background, things are happening.
But Gil wants us to know that we still need to invest in improving our electrical grid and infrastructure so that it's more resilient to weather events and energy surges.
And there are many ways to do it, but when we are doing it, that, and we also can add the smart grid options and think about how to make the grid more independent, so one failure in one location will not create a failure in another location. And it all comes together.
NSPR's Dave Sholm, host of NSPR's Blue Dot. That last voice you heard was Dr. Gil Tal, head of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at UC Davis. And that's Insight for today. You can learn more about Blue Dot and all of the guests that we heard from today at capradio.org/insight. And thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Technical director is Mark Jones. Engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Catch us back here tomorrow when we'll be talking about federal and state stimulus programs. I'm Randall White. Have a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.